We're rolling right now.
Well, that was amazing and super fun. I feel like I need to calm down a little. Like, sometimes you get a little worked up after these. Get a little excited. No, that was great. We just had Tom Wilson in studio. I'm over with the Graham MacGuffin podcast over at Graham MacGuffin Studios with Morgan and Dave right now. Steven's also here. Say hey, guys.
Hey, what's guys. Going on?
Boom. So that was amazing. This episode is, well, it's brought to you by a couple sponsors, so I'll go ahead and get that out of the way because I've got it on the tip of my tongue. We've got LuLaRoe, ZL, and Liz, and they are actually the ones who gave me the fabulous dress I'm actually wearing in the Facebook Live video from the interview that I just did. It's super comfy. I look real cute, and it's a hot, sweaty garage in Northridge, y'all. Keeping it together, one cute dress at a time. So LuLaRoe is the company. LuLaRoe, ZL, and Liz, they are my consultants for that. And you can check them out on Facebook. You join their group. And if you message Liz with the promo code Jackson, that's J-A-C-K-S-O-N, you will get a discount on some cute clothes, maybe even something like what I'm wearing right now. Also, we are brought to you by Snow Monster Studios, who is our new mother network. We're very excited to be joining Snow Monster Studios as a continuous project for them. They are based in Grand Rapids, Michigan. They are a motion capture and VR studio. We are very excited to be a part of their network. And in 2017, we are going to be offering podcast workshops and classes. We're going to be doing an intro to podcasting sort of event over at the studio in Grand Rapids, Michigan. So if you're in the Chicago or Detroit area, please feel free to check us out as well. We're like a 3-hour drive and there's like a lot of cool shit to do in Grand Rapids. It's Beer City, USA. So check that out. Also, shout out to some of our sister shows. We've got Geek World Order. They have got an awesome website. It's got news, reviews, videos, basically anything that you need for, you know, your geek fix, you can get at Geek World Order. So check them out. They're at geekworldordersite.com. And then, oh God, do we have any more sponsors? I have so many sponsors now. I have so many people. I know, right? I have so many people trying to just give me money. No, but yeah, thanks to all our sponsors, and a big shout out to the Grand MacGuffin podcast, our brother show as well. And they are launching their own, well, they've got the Grand MacGuffin network, but Grand MacGuffin TV, GMGTV, is launching soon, right, Morgan? I would love to.
Zing.
Also excited to actually have all the guys of Graham MacGuffin on Super Hungry coming up as well. And that's going to be including Mr. Robot as well. So we'll have those guys. And man, this was just a great conversation. Tom Wilson and I met a couple years ago. We worked on a show called Zack Stone is Going to Be Famous on MTV. And reached out to him. And he so graciously just came to the fucking garage in Northridge. No offense, Dave. This is a beautiful garage. It's just I'm saying.
It's a fucking garage.
We just had Tom Wilson in your garage in Northridge. So he was just here for like over an hour because Lord knows I cannot keep it short. But it was awesome. We talked about, you know, his start in stand-up. You know, he's from Philly. He lived in New York. He did stand-up. He worked at the Comedy Store for a long time. He was the doorman for Richard Pryor. Like, spoiler alert for that. I had no idea. You know, we talk about, obviously, little small movie he did called Back to the Future. I think you might have heard of it. There was, I think, a sequel or two. So we briefly touch on that. But really what we talk about is the process of what it is to sort of be an actor, you know, in television, in films, in big films and small films. How do you adapt as an actor and an artist to the projects that you're given? He's also a really incredible painter. So when you listen to this episode, be sure to check out the website post as well, because I'm going to be posting some stills of some of his paintings and stuff that you can check out. And man, it was just a great conversation. I felt really inspired. He had a lot of great advice about continuing to do your art, and I was very happy to hear him speak on the fact that the doing of the thing is the thing, and that is something that I think Super Hungry fans and listeners know is really the theme of the show, right? It's about finding what keeps you hungry and what drives you. And so please enjoy this conversation with Tom Wilson.
I was on set 2 days ago, and I was in an elevator 3 times, full of people, 3 different times. A David Pumpkins joke did not land. Not a single person in the elevator knew. And I was like, this was a thing, though. Like,
give it time. Give it time. Cowbell took a while. Cowbell took a while to actually get some traction. You know, the people of the red hand will rule, you know, that when they cannibalize each other, when they, you know, the Will Ferrell, did you see that one? And the Good Morning, whatever, Cincinnati, and the teleprompter breaks and they have no idea what to say. They go to commercial, they come back and it's complete, you know, Lord of the Flies.
Everything's like on fire, yeah. I miss him so much. Oh, God. Anyway, so we're live. We're recording.
Yes.
We're live. Are we
Let's
live
go.
On Facebook? Is everything... Oh my God, technology is amazing. So thanks for coming by, Tom. This is exciting.
My pleasure.
Do you
want to
put earphones on?
I do not, unless we have, you know, callers calling in from Long Island. No, we don't have anybody.
No.
I mean, I sort of know
Facebook,
how my
they'll
voice
Facebook
sounds.
Type in. So it's
oh,
fine.
Facebook. Type into Facebook and caller 7. We got some tickets to Foghat.
I was going to make a joke about not knowing who Foghat was.
I know. Like nobody
I
knows who Foghat was.
But
that's
I knew it.
Why
but
I used
knew
it for
it,
a
though.
Reference.
Like, I knew it.
If I said some other band that
Beyonce,
people knew, not comedy.
Would not, no.
Comedy is Blue Oyster Cult.
So thank you for being here. I'm so
it's
excited
my pleasure to
be
here.
It's been
thank
a long
you
time
for
since we've
me.
Actually seen each other. It's
yes,
been a
I
few
haven't
years.
Seen you for, yeah, since Zack Stone.
Yeah, which we were
Who actually
on...
didn't become famous.
He didn't.
They promised it.
Spoiler alert.
Spoiler alert. Zack Stone did not become famous.
So I had, I've had a couple other of the guys from Zack Stone on too, and we've all made versions of that exact same joke every time. And they're like, it didn't really work out for him.
It was a great show. It was a great show
it was
that I'm
honestly,
very, very
brilliant.
Happy.
Like,
yeah. It was really, it was, the audience didn't understand.
Mm-mm.
Anything about they didn't understand that
I think
it was
too meta for the audience and the network we were on.
It was
basically.
Meta of meta, yes, it was.
You know,
yes, it was. But it was a great show, and happy to have been a part of it. Bo Burnham, you know, great person, very creative artist that I loved working with,
so
and all
creative.
That stuff. So it was all good.
Yeah,
it's all good. I mean, that stuff, it's probably going to fail if it's sort of clever.
And you're laughing on set. You're like, oh.
And
no
you just know
like
it's
this.
Not,
yeah.
You know, it's probably not going to happen because it's, you know, it's difficult to understand for that audience.
Yeah. That was my first job, you know, like my first like real like long term like assistant job was that one.
Obviously.
I was just going to tell you a story about how nice you were to me on set and how we had this really great moment.
That's why I was so nice. I was nice and I was patient. No, you're great. You're great. It was very nice working with you there. You were great. You're professional. And as you know, look, people, you don't, it's no magic formula to how to work on a set like that. You just come and be smart and work hard.
And just learn.
And learn.
Yeah.
And it falls into place. It's not some, oh, you need the combination lock to the gigantic safe that no one knows how to get into. No, I mean, it's pretty clear how to get into it. Just be smart and be prepared to work hard and learn things and remember them as you're going. And I think you'll be fine.
And carry like 4 different bags. I was like, people started nicknaming me. They joked me that I was the Sherpa on set because I would have like my bag of current scripts because we would block shoot like 2 episodes at a time and stuff. It was good. I took a lot of on-set naps. I learned how to nap on set on that show. But yeah, so we met a couple years ago, but just going back to sort of like the beginning, because like I said, I want to know, like you're from Philly. You're from Philadelphia.
I grew up in Philadelphia.
Yeah. You know? So were you born in Philly or like a suburb?
I was born in Philadelphia in the city.
That's cool.
I was a city kid with, you know, streets and alleys and all that kind of stuff.
Roads
playing,
and pavement.
Well,
and
playing
everything.
Like stick ball, all that, you know, just an East Coast... East Coast cliche kid, just playing stickball in an alley.
Do you like the East Coast or the West Coast better?
I like both.
Yeah.
I like both because they're both great things. I'm an East Coast guy, born and raised on the East Coast, like every East Coast guy. You move to California and you start going, this place is terrible, man. They don't have this, whatever, you know, this kind of sandwich. You know, they don't have that soda that I like to drink. And, you know, so yes,
yeah.
If you're from another place and you come to Los Angeles, California, guess what?
You hate it a little
bit. It's not the place that you grew up in.
Right.
Okay? Newsflash. So you hate it for a while. Now, I think the people who aren't very bright, they remain hating it for the rest of their life. And they don't have fun here at all.
Right.
And they're just, their whole entire life becomes a resentment about living. Yeah, this place, they don't even have this. The leaves turn. Oh, when I will grow, no leaves turning. I've seen snow. You know, whatever it is. Okay? If you want to have a pleasant life and enjoy yourself, hey, you know, you have to come to the conclusion, wait a minute. Why, Los Angeles isn't New York City. Maybe I should try to enjoy Los Angeles, beautiful California, for what it is. They have mountains and beaches. They have many, many cultural centers of every kind of culture.
Marijuana.
Yeah, well, that's your thing, but whatever.
Yeah, sure.
Clearly, by the way, you worked on Zack Stone. But
on set naps.
But you can find everything here. It's easy to hate, quote-unquote, California culture.
Yeah.
Because you have to spend enough time here to understand that it's not one culture.
Yeah.
It's 7 million cultures. It's all microcultures within a gigantic, mm-hmm. gigantic piece of land that you can't entirely figure out if you lived here your whole life.
Oh, yeah. I feel that way, and I just hit like the five-year mark in October, and I'm like, I haven't even been to certain parts of area that's like close to where I live.
Right, because it's horizontal. It's a very horizontal city.
Yeah.
Because once people figured out, well, this is going to be a big city and we have cars and everything. Yeah, New York, that you hit a river.
Yeah.
And then you have to go up. You know, out here, it's like, well, why don't we build it over there? I mean, you know, we can keep building it until we hit those mountains. And then all you have to do is build a road through this low part of the mountain and then just build past there.
I have some bosses that are like people that I know that have like lived in like the Palisades and they like drive all the way up to Burbank or something.
Oh,
every
people
day.
Live
and I'm just like,
very, very
what?
Far from where they work here. And they just decide to, again, they decide, I'm going to have a comfortable life. On the weekends, I'm going to enjoy myself.
Yeah.
But during the week, yeah, it's going to be a difficult drive.
Yeah.
And I'm going to drive in order to work and live. And live where I want to live.
Yeah.
But anyone who you know, I mean, if you don't enjoy a beautiful sunset in an ocean, mm-hmm. or skiing in the morning, surfing in the afternoon, or going to any kind of cultural experience at a restaurant that you could possibly imagine,
yeah, the food
within a
so
few
good.
Minutes of your house, then yeah, maybe it's not for you.
Yeah.
You know, but you can find everything here. I mean, you can live on a ranch with horses.
Up in the valley or like the mountains.
Yeah, right.
And stuff.
You can live in an area where people speak Spanish exclusively.
Yeah.
But hey, wait a minute. You can live in an area where people speak Korean exclusively or Vietnamese exclusively. So again, I'm overdue, but you know, it's a giant thing that you can't figure out, but it's probably smarter to just make peace with it.
Yeah.
You know.
How long have you been out here?
I've been out here a very, very long time. How old are you, Virginia?
I am 27.
I've been out here a very, very long time.
So talking about driving a little bit, I was lurking your IMDb page, and your first credit was for Knight Rider.
Was it?
Yeah. How did that happen?
Well, the Knight Rider thing happened. Can I go back a little bit?
Sure.
I was living in New York, and I was studying acting, and I was acting in theater, and I was very young. I was physically large, so you know when you're like 19, and a big guy.
Yeah.
There's just, of course, you're hungry. You know, you're hungry to get on stage. You're hungry to be in a show. You want to show your stuff. You've got some chops, and you want to get up there. But of course, they're just like plays don't have a part like that. They just, you know, an Arthur Miller play comes up and there's not a 6'3", 19-year-old guy in Arthur Miller plays.
Right.
So it's very frustrating. So I started to do, I started to do improv. I started to do stand-up comedy.
Where'd you study? Did you study improv there, or did you just start doing?
No, that learning? Back then there was no, you know, wow. Now we get in my electric wheelchair of show business. Back in those days, they didn't, but
I was
going
to put you on one of those wheelchairs that's just attached to the wall.
Yeah, there was improv as a part of a rehearsal process for a play.
Oh.
And then there were improv games that were basically collected in a book by a woman named Viola Spolin.
Okay.
So there were Spolin exercises that you would do improv from there. But there weren't classes at all like that you know them now.
Yeah.
They were just, hey, you got up on stage and you just did improv. And you started with those exercises. Hey, everybody, audience, give me a first line and a last line. Give me all those kinds of games that you would play.
Yeah.
So, but it was, you know, I'm not saying it was a new thing, but it was a relatively new experience for the audience members who were coming out to a thing that they kind of hadn't seen before.
Yeah.
And didn't know really what to expect.
Did you end up starting to get enough of a following to where you had the same audiences coming to where they knew when you would come out in improv, like kind of what was happening? Like, were you in a cusp where you could kind of see the shift happen?
Yes. Well, that in the early 80s, yes, you saw a shift begin to happen because, you know, in 1979, I started doing that sort of thing. And it was really doing it at coffee houses and all the, you know, the same thing that young people do now. It was, hey, wherever they have like a light bulb and people sitting in some chairs, like, well, let's do a show. But Saturday Night Live was out. And not that, it Saturday Night Live began in 1975. Mm-hmm. But that was the, you know, the boom of Saturday Night Live when it really grew. It really became huge. Steve Martin became a huge star, and stand-up, specifically stand-up, even more than improv, but stand-up became the thing to see. It was the hippest thing that you could possibly see. Weird to say now because it doesn't really make sense, you know, because that image of the brick wall, the guy standing with the microphone.
Right.
How many people do this, huh? You ever eat asparagus? And it's like, whatever, that thing. But then it was, you know, it was relatively new. Seeing Steve Martin, seeing David Steinberg, Robert Klein on The Tonight Show.
And you were around for all of it. Like, were you, like, in and around a lot of with these guys, too? Because they were in New York at the same time? Or?
Yeah, well, I was, at the very beginning, I was around it a little bit, like, seeing those guys. But they were, you know, they were way above anything I was doing.
Okay.
You know, I was playing bars and things, you know. But at that time, there were few enough people doing it that you could actually get on stage at the improv the comedy store, where now everyone knows, and performers know, it's nearly an impossible task because so many people, the numbers are so huge of that, you know, you're a salmon swimming upstream and it seems everyone's doing it. And that's the, how do you get on stage?
Right.
And back then, though it was a severe winnowing process, the learning curve was very steep and you couldn't necessarily stay on stage. You know what I mean? But if you were willing to work hard, you could get on stage.
And you did stand up too, right?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Do you remember your first set?
My first set was, I was very young. So I was studying acting. I was auditioning for theater. I was getting some little experimentally theater things, but really nothing much. So my friends, a couple guys I knew, did stand-up. And I went to see them. And honestly, I was very young, and I was an acting theater snob. I was, you know, and I was God's gift to acting, and I was going to be a serious artist. And I was coming to this, you know, with the people, I don't know what they do, at the end of your little, what do you call it, a set? Maybe they throw food at you, I'm not sure. But the little people drinking their beer and eating their little chicken wings. How nice for you to do a show in front of a crowd like that. I perform before audiences. I suppose crowds are more your cup of tea. So, yeah. But
how long did that last?
That lasted a very short period of time. Very short period of time. Because really, they did it, and honestly, a lot of it was mercenary. The first time I ever performed was basically, and now I could tell my children or my grandchildren that one time I stooped low enough to do that stand-up shtick thing that they do.
I'm imagining you at like 19. For some reason, you're wearing football pads in my brain because you said you were very burly. And then
I wasn't burly when I was 19. I wasn't burly when I was.
You said
like,
tall
like that.
And big.
I was tall.
Like
I was tall.
Oh, just tall. Okay.
I was tall.
I just imagine like a very like serious tall young man. Like
yeah, I was pretty. I wasn't a. I was like I suppose physically large,
yeah.
But I was never a burly burly put guys in a headlock guy.
Oh
no,
I am.
Are you? Of
yeah,
course you are.
Obviously. I mean,
no.
Me.
I was sick when I was in school. I missed like 2 years of high
oh,
school,
wow.
basically, off and on with asthma, and I was in the hospital a lot. And,
oh, I didn't know that.
And then later in high school, when I was that kid who was like skinny, coughing in the hospital a lot, and then sometime during 11th grade, you know, my genes kicked in.
Yeah.
And I just grew over a summer. You grow 8 inches, gain 60 pounds, and come back. Like, what's going on? You are the people who have been bothering me since third grade. Now I will get my revenge. I wasn't the burly guy at all. But so I did one show. Didn't go particularly well.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, so you get off stage. You think, oh, well, okay. I can always say I did it. The next night, a friend calls me. He says, we have a gig in New Jersey. You know, a guy fell out. We don't have it. We need 3 guys for the show.
Yeah.
I said, I don't even... Like, I'm not a stand-up comedian. What do you mean? He goes, it's $10, and they feed you dinner. I'm like, what? You get paid? You get, I mean, just to do what you guys do, like to goof off on stage? Like, just to, I mean, literally, to like fool around
yeah.
in front of people. You get paid. Yeah, $10 and a cheeseburger. Pick me up. I'm ready to go.
You're like, I would have done it for the cheeseburger.
So, right. So, honestly, the first... impulse, of course, the first impulse for stand-up is going on stage. But honestly, it was completely mercenary. I was really starving. I mean, I didn't have any money at all. Then I was eating one little thing of ramen every day,
yeah.
every day. Like that
was it.
That was it. Yeah. The weird thing is, in like 1978, ramen costs exactly what it costs now. So, either. Either the ramen was incredibly overpriced when I was buying it, or they've taken something out of the ramen, vitamins or something, or they...
I think any sort of actual nutritional value.
Yeah,
basically
it did.
Basically, like church
so, yeah,
community.
I was really starving. Like, I had no money. My dad was sick and in the hospital a lot and everything. So our family, we didn't have any money. So it was really like $10 at a cheeseburger. I'll have money tomorrow to take the subway. I'll have a cheeseburger. I'm going.
Right.
Literally in the car, I'm trying to think up like funny things that you might do on stage, you know, and picking up props. And so that first show was mostly just a solo improvisation of a person who has no idea what he's doing.
Did you get any laughs?
Just I got some laughs.
Oh, good.
I mean, it was like just sheer... like molten energy just coming out, you know, I will myself to succeed. And, you know, and I suppose it's like, you know, a lot
just
of the people might be like, wow, this kid's nuts or whatever. But it kind of went over.
Yeah.
And then I started performing more and a few guys. But I always thought, well, I'm going to act. I'm really an actor
yeah.
who does stand up. And some guy, Rich Hall. Became a friend of mine. Rich, you might not know Rich. He was in Saturday Night Live's cast a number of years ago. Great, like, filmmaker, and very clever comedian. And Rich, we had this talk, and he said, you know, you're waiting around to be an actor. Like, you're waiting for them to give you a chance to be on some cop show. I'm going out and doing a show that I wrote tonight.
Right.
So, you know, it's like really dawned on me
yeah.
that it is theater.
Is that when you kind of started shifting your inner perspective of it to where
yep.
you were
that's
like...
when I really like opened, like got a notebook you know, took out one of my old spiral bounds,
right.
You know, opened it. Okay, what do I think is funny and what might I do on stage that people might enjoy? And just writing stuff down and going out to bars and clubs and, you know, some restaurant, you know, Wednesday night disco, Thursday comedy, Friday foxy boxing, whatever.
There's not enough foxy boxing around anymore.
So I did a lot of that.
That's cool.
For a long, long time. And then moved out here and, you know, and got a job at the Comedy Store in the pros, where, you know, I was always acting, but I'm kind of scattered in my telling of the story. So if you have any questions, please.
I was going to say, was your Comedy Store connection out here because of being in New York then? Was that?
No, I came out here not knowing anyone. I knew Rich. Rich was out here. A couple of guys were at the Improv, and I thought that I would be a comedian at the Improv largely, because mostly it's like who ends up liking you, you know?
Right.
So who just ends up calling and say, hey, you can call in for spots and perform here. So I was living in New York. A couple of casting people kindly, I didn't take it kindly when I was young. I didn't, you know, I was sort of insulted by it, but they meant well, and they were being nice to me. Separately, took me aside to basically say, look, I think you're really talented. You really have talent. But in plays today, we're not looking for anything that's like you. You know, there's nothing to put you in. There's nothing to cast you in the plays. Everything was very small. Al Pacino doing Shakespeare. Everything was a like a 5'7" guy with
right.
dark hair and you know that intensity. And they're saying, I know you're an East Coast guy. I know you have that proper intensity, but you look like you're from Nebraska. You know, you look like you're in the musical Oklahoma. You're such a big, just American guy.
Right.
We just don't. There's nothing for you here right now. And they said, you should move to California and probably do TV shows or commercials or whatever in order to make a living.
So what was that like in that moment, having for as long as you did kind of been on this track in your mind of like, oh, I'm going to do like theater. I'm going to be in New
right.
York. I'm going to like stay in this. Like, what was that to have two separate
well,
people tell
yes,
you that?
Being Mr. Acting Intensity and the savior of the American theater, as I was then, you know, I was like, these people don't understand that when I'm doing stand-up, I'm, you know, I'm doing something that's from inside of me.
Right.
I mean, I'm sharing. I'm going into the cave and bringing it out on stage. When I'm at an audition for a play, I'm not just going to be, I mean, I'm doing something that's important. I'm not going to go out and get on Dukes of Hazzard and do a hair gel commercial. That's not me. Okay. So, you know, that guy, look, I make fun of myself, but you know, when you're young, I think you're supposed to feel that way. You're supposed to take your work with that kind of work ethic and that kind of intensity.
Yeah.
That you absolutely you take it seriously.
Because you have to. Because if you can't expect other people to take you seriously, if you don't take you
right.
seriously, I think that's the mentality behind
right.
it. It's
so
like...
I was working very hard at it. And when you're, you know, when you're a young guy and you're working hard, of course, you want people to look at you and say, wow, you're working hard.
Right.
Right. You want people to notice it.
Yeah.
And say, whoa, it's such hard work. And, you know, you don't want to necessarily move to California, but the writing was on the wall. The writing was on the wall. So I moved out here and started. I was accepted at the Comedy Store. I became a regular there. It was like going up to Dodger Stadium.
Yeah,
you know, and seeing all these comedians and wow, like the main room of the Comedy Store is 400 people packed. And Robin Williams is performing there and Billy Crystal's performing there. Richard Pryor's performing there every night. And it's, you know, and it's sort of like somebody comes up to you and hands you a Dodgers jersey.
Right.
And kind of like, okay, kid, put this on, get up there. And you're like, whoa, this is big show business. This is where it's all happening.
Yeah.
So I got accepted there as a regular.
What was that feeling, I guess, having that be the first place after you moved to the West Coast that really was like, oh, we see you. We see what you're doing.
I thought, as I said, a few of my friends worked at the Improv here on Melrose. I thought that I would be accepted there. I went there to the open mic night. You put your name in a big bucket. Mm-hmm. And as the night goes on, they pick the next four names. Get ready, everybody. Get ready. My name was never picked. You just sit there. You have to sit there from about 5:30 in the afternoon.
Until
as
like
many,
two
yeah, as many people listening to me know. You stand there 5:30. You put your name in the bucket. And you sit there nursing that water until 2 o'clock in the morning. And you're just waiting to get on stage. And and it was, it's like out of a movie. A guy, one of the performers, he's sitting at this old piano at the Improv. And the guy comes out, he picks the last four names. And there are, you know, there are like 12, 15 people who just waited hours, including me. And they're not going to get on stage. The guy starts playing the piano and starts singing, "There's no business like show business like no." It's like a movie. Then this person, the guy over here who was refused, who's not getting on stage, he starts with the guy, "Everything about it is appealing." I couldn't believe my eyes. Everyone starts, "Everything the traffic will allow."
It's like an alternate Shining.
It's 2:30 in the morning on Melrose Avenue. "Nowhere can you get that happy feeling when you are still." Everybody, oh, "There's no people. You know, let's go on with the show." Okay. Next night, I audition. I go to the Comedy Store. I know. Pardon me. I'm sorry. I'll turn this
I'm
to
just
silent.
Happy you have an iPhone, so.
Sorry. The next night, I show up at the Comedy Store. I know no one there. I just put my name on the list. Inexplicably, Mitzi Shore, the owner of the place, comes in, sits in her booth. I go on stage. I do very well. She says, you know, you're the guy who runs the show comes up, says, "You're a regular. You're a regular at the Comedy Store. Call in Monday for your spots." What? Yeah, whoa. You're regular. You're performing here all the time. Call in for your spots on Mondays. We get the schedule at the end of Monday. Then you get to your spots for the week. And they had two locations, one in Westwood and one in Hollywood.
Yeah.
And then I just started there. So, and then after a few weeks, I was performing there. And they asked if I would be a doorman, sort of like a bouncer, like you know, you're like, you're a big guy now.
I get asked for those jobs all the time.
Of course,
yeah.
You're a big guy. Here's the thing. I said, I'm not the doorman. Like, I'm a performer, man. Here, oh no. Here, if somebody doesn't show up for their spot, you're going to be the first guy on the list to get their spot.
Oh.
When you're first beginning there, you're not going to get a lot of spots. You're not going to get prime real estate spots. But
doorman's
if you're
like understudy.
Right, doorman's standing there all night long. This guy doesn't show up for the spot, and it's 9:30, and the crowd is packed and everything. Boom, you're on stage. Mm-hmm. So it's a good way to get stage time. So, okay. So while Richard Pryor was working on his material, this is before cable TV, he would work out the sets that he would do for a feature film. He would work on, say, an hour and a half of comedy material. Then he would perform that with movie cameras, cut it together, and release it as a movie. So he would work out all that material at Sunset, at the Comedy Store. So I was the doorman for all of those shows that he did every night, night after night, watching him write the material, kind of improvise, you know, do his thing and shave down the material into an hour or an hour and a half of killer material. I also, of course, had to walk up to you know, tables of eight African-American gentlemen and say, "You fellas are going to have to simmer down. Mr. Pryor's working on stage. Come on. Don't give me any problems now."
Did you use the deep voice every time?
I would do the deep voice and I would do the big guy thing. You spread your chest a little bit and just, "All right, men, that's about enough out of you. You want," and you just hope it. Because, see, I was an actor.
Yeah.
I thought, I can act like a bouncer.
Right.
It's a character. So, you know, so in my head, I'm going, "You and your drunk friends are out of here. Come on, don't make me carry you out." Inside, "Please don't hit me. Please don't hit me. Please, Mr. Man, don't hit me." So I actually never got in a big fight there.
I was
there.
Actually going to ask if you ever did get
in a fight. No, I had to throw some guys around a little bit.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow.
It's,
I was going to say, is it as exciting as, like, are there as many?
No, I didn't, like, you know, I mean, no, I don't want to beef with anybody. Right, I'm like a lover, not a fighter.
I just always imagine throwing a punch whenever it happens. It would be exciting. Like, I've never had to do it, but I imagine it would be exciting, right?
I've
like,
never,
my fingers would probably break, but,
yeah,
like, it
I've
would
never
be worth it.
Actually punched anybody.
I haven't either. I just make threats.
Because I'm afraid to punch, you know, I'm a pretty big dude, and I'm afraid to just, you know, boom. I may end up in prison or something. I can put you sort of on the ground quickly. I can, you know, I would do that. I can,
like,
if there's something happening,
I can neutralize
and
the situation
things and arms
if
are
I
flying
need
around,
to.
I can sort of give you a nice special bear hug, and we can go to the ground,
right.
And then I can tell you really close to your face, you know, like, we're done struggling now.
And then,
like,
they just
stop.
Fall asleep.
And then they fall asleep.
It's
I rub
deep
their tummy.
And dream of sleep.
It's like alligators. It's
yeah,
weird.
Exactly.
You rub their tummy and then they're like resting. They're sort of hypnotized. But I mean, I did that in order to get stage time.
Yeah.
And then.
What was that like, though? Sorry, just to go back to the prior thing. Like, that must have been like such a, like, education, right? To sort of even to see him, just because you talked about how he would, you know, kind of take bits and like shave them down and like work them down. Like, even as like a, you know, because I imagine a lot of those stores, depending on where the room is, you can kind of hear some of the sets still if you're a doorman. Because
oh sure,
yeah,
no,
like
I paid a lot of,
like,
attention to the
I
set.
I mean, was like, well, I just he, like, those kind of guys were so iconic. So as a young comic coming up, I can imagine how, you know, you it just must have been.
Well, it was, yes,
like,
it was
it
was an amazing time. It was an amazing time, and as I said, that was, you know, it was before. It became sort of an archetype,
right,
of what we look at when we think of a stand-up comedian.
Right.
Now you just say that, and people have an image. Oh, it's a brick wall, and it's a guy observing things. You ever notice how things are? But before it became an archetype like that, really you saw many, many varied styles of performing and writing and approaches to sets and prop comedians and political comedians, observational comedians, all kinds of different things. The great part then was I found it a rather collegial environment. I think there was a little bit, of course, comedians have egos and everyone thinks that everyone should do comedy in the way that they do it.
Right.
But I felt that then it was a more open field. There was more kind of opportunity to go after your vision of the way that you feel the audience is responding to you.
Yeah.
Not forcing it down their throats in some, again, making the archetype.
Right.
And being afraid to go outside of that because maybe the audience says, well, this is not what I recognize as stand-up comedy.
Right.
Does that make sense?
No, totally. I feel personally, and this is just, I don't know if anybody else in the room can echo it, but like, in the very limited time I've done comedy or just tried to do anything like that, I weirdly think that that's almost like coming back around again because you're seeing, at least in a lot of these like smaller comedy stages, like, you're seeing people do such fucking weird.
I completely
weird,
agree
like,
with you. I try, and I'm, you know, I admit, I'm a stand-up dinosaur around.
You're so
but
funny.
I do the Meltdown show.
Yeah.
I do the Living Room show. I try to do.
R.I.P. Meltdown, right? They're
well, R.I.P. Meltdown,
yeah.
Absolutely. Aww. But I, you know, I try to do things, and you know, I've really been inspired by some of the young people that are coming to that kind of show.
Yeah.
Because I think for a very long time, people were expecting and looking for the archetype.
Mm-hmm.
And now I think a lot of people are coming out to a show like Meltdown, RIP, like a lot of these shows, not fully knowing what to expect.
Yeah.
And young performers, which is great,
are
just coming up with something unusual that's out of their vision for what they might do on stage and just putting it out there.
Do you have any favorite young comedians right now that you've seen?
I hate them.
Oh, great.
Because they're young. They have their whole lives ahead of them.
Stealing your work.
I'll tell you. I try to be positive toward all comedians.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Who are
it's fucking
working.
Hard.
It's very
difficult to get up on stage
and
tell
hard.
Jokes.
And my my thing is if you think it's that easy, then get up there and give it a shot.
Yeah.
You know? Or come on up here, take the mic from me and let's see you try because it's a very hard thing to do.
Yeah.
So almost everybody is working and trying to present their vision You know, the way that they look at the world, mm-hmm. you know? And when they're very new to the stage, they're probably doing it in a style that, you know, that you've seen before
yeah.
of somebody else, of course, because yeah. they're just starting.
You have to work it out.
Yeah, right. Yeah. You're like a baby on stage. You have to work that out. You have to try to find your voice, mm-hmm. try to find ways that audiences are connecting with you, and then pursue that.
Yeah.
But as you know, look, it takes a lot of work.
Oh, yeah.
A lot of work.
And I've only done stand-up, like, a little bit. And then I realized, you know, like, with the show, with doing this, is, like, a different thing. Because especially when I do, like, live shows, it's, like, a whole, like, I have to be, like, on. You know, you have to, like, be, you know, it's,
well,
like,
you have to be a character because
yeah,
you can't.
Like, you can't just be a.
You can't be like, Virginia who had a bad day and yeah, just wants to go, to, like, hey, I'm sharing my bad day with everyone. Yeah, okay, like, man. I came out in the car
yeah.
with a girl. I mean,
I
I'm
drove
paying
here.
Like this Long Island iced tea isn't cheap, you know. Yeah. This thing was like $12.50. I mean, I'm you know, like damn. I don't mean you don't have to juggle plates, yeah. but I mean it's like sort of a show.
I can't remember. I think it was Pete Holmes, who's a really funny comedian, LA based. I'm sure you know Pete.
Mm-hmm, sure, I know Pete.
He said something on his podcast that was like mind blowing for me, and he was like, I realized one day when I was in the middle of a show, he's like you know, they flew me out, they put me up, they've got me, you know, whatever, and he's like, people paid money to come see me. He's like, and it's like it didn't even dawn on me until I was there, and he's like, they want a good show, you know, like you want a good show, you want to give a good show. He's like, you have to like leave all that other shit, whatever it is, like there, like, but then you're I think right. it's that's almost like not a hard and fast rule though, because now that I'm even saying this, I think of somebody like Tig Notaro, who took, you know, her cancer diagnosis and then went over to the Largo and did like one of the most like crazy powerful sets ever. But even that, I feel like, is still I feel like anytime you're on stage, it's a version of yourself. It's like an enhanced, like hyper realized kind of like version of who you are, right?
It is, and it's important. For Tig's show, and I'm not faulting it, but Tig has an audience
yeah.
who's ready to hear something that she wants to share.
Exactly.
In that way.
Yeah.
You know, which is a great thing.
Yeah.
Which is a great thing.
That wraps back to kind of what we were saying about comedy now diversifying a bit.
Absolutely.
And being able to have these
Absolutely.
Different audiences.
And when the audience supports you in that way. And I yeah. mean, they want, look, they would support Richard Pryor.
Yeah.
For a long time. It yeah. depends on how famous you are or how much your crowd loves you.
Right.
Of how much credit you get early on, you know. Oh, he's on a TV show. I'll listen to him for 4 minutes and see if he's terrible. Whatever. Oh, Richard Pryor.
Right.
We're going to listen to him. We understand why we're here. We're watching him work material out. We're watching him improvise. We're allowed to be in here watching the process.
Yeah.
And then we'll see the movie and go, wow, it's different than the way that I saw it.
Right.
You know. So he got a long time. This person gets a shorter time. And of course, on open mic night, you have to kind of go out there and, you know, and just work it because.
Give it your all.
And give it your
yeah.
all. Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. I've only done like one open mic in LA. And I literally, it was like I was there from like 6 or something. And they were like, oh, sorry. The sign up actually secretly starts at 5. So there are 30 comedians already on the list.
A lot of the comedy dinosaurs, like, yeah, a lot of the comedy dinosaurs like myself talk about. Like when we were young and going out 7 nights a week, like multiple venues per yeah. night, not like it's not necessarily how great that was. Oh, wasn't it exciting? We don't overly romanticize that time, although it was a romantic time, but it does speak to how desperate we were.
You're
it like, speaks to how desperate
yeah.
you are to get on stage.
Yeah.
You know, it's just not, it's a lot of the comfortable guys. A lot of the guys that could go back to mom and dad and work at dad's firm or whatever it was, mm-hmm. they didn't last.
Yeah.
Because it gets that hard.
Yeah.
It gets that hard.
I've heard even being on the road is like a whole different thing too. What is it like for you when you have to like travel to do shows? Is that something that can be really like grueling if you're doing like a longer
grueling.
Like tour and stuff?
It's very grueling.
Do you ever bring your family on things
no.
like that or no?
Okay. No. I mean, sometimes like my son is older now, my daughter, if I do Las Vegas or something, they like
oh,
just
fun.
The lights and doing stuff or seeing shows and things like that. So that's a nice thing. But generally, it's a lot of work.
Yeah.
It's a lot of work.
Yeah.
I'm up at 5:30, 6 in the morning doing morning radio. Promoting the show.
Crazy
Everybody,
Ira
yeah.
and the Douche.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. It's Wiggy Jim and the Wave with cha-cha. Hey, I'm hot. You know, and it's just, wow. And
I do want to be a cha-cha for a day, though. Right. Just for a day.
Well, you do that all morning, yeah. And then you have two shows at night, sometimes three on Saturday. So it is, it's great. It's performing. It's doing your art form, but there's no doubt about it. It is working.
Yeah. So how did Comedy Store, being the sort of doorman, being that like alternate, how did that transition then into what then would be like, you know, TV work, like Knight Rider, like doing something
when,
like that?
When agents would come, I was the doorman. I would seat them and I would find out, I would look at everything. I would ask friends and I would find out if a TV show or a play was casting a specific role. And as I was seating them, I was saying, I would say, like, I don't have an agent. I need an agent. They're casting this role. I think I'm right for it. I'm not asking you to be my agent. I'm just asking you to submit me for this role. And if I do well, you know, you see.
Yeah. Did that work?
It worked.
Holy shit.
It worked. A guy came, said, okay, I'll send you in for that. I went in. I didn't get the role. But the casting director reported back to the agent. I said, you know, he's really good. I mean, he's not right for this. He's too tall or whatever, but he's really good. The guy calls me, says, you know, they said you're a really good actor. So why don't you come in and we'll talk about things. He became my agent. And then I started working.
Wow.
And once I started auditioning, it has been a very, very circuitous, difficult process for me over 37 years. But I started working almost immediately and I've been pretty much working since then. You know, there have been desert parts, you know,
right,
where I'm doing a lot of stand up on the road or something. There's a lot of parts where you think, is this over? Do people in a van come up and tell you? Yeah, you're right. That was it. You know, and then things kind of pick up a little bit, but, I was auditioning for commercials, and early on, that thing, that big American kid from Nebraska looking thing. So I got a chewing gum commercial. I got a commercial.
They chew gum in Nebraska.
I got a commercial for Swiss Miss Hot Chocolate. Hmm. You know, hey, what a great thing. It's hot chocolate that you just pour into a cup, you know, that kind of thing. I did, I introduced biscuits at Kentucky Fried Chicken. Yeah, before me, when you went to Kentucky Fried Chicken, or KFC, I'm sorry, it was chicken, potatoes, and a drink. May I have a biscuit? We don't have them. Yeah. So I was
in the
commercial. I was in the national commercial as a construction worker, young construction worker. Yeah, he had chicken. He had a drink.
Wow.
Yeah, he had
some
potatoes.
So many
but no, something
biscuits
was missing. What? He had no biscuit. Fresh buttermilk biscuits made from scratch. Boink, a biscuit popped into my hand. And, you know, from then on, KFC had biscuits.
I feel like I'm in an
You're
episode
welcome.
Of Fairy Home Companion right now.
Yeah. So I did that kind of thing. That kind of thing. And then I started getting cast in TV shows. Knight Rider was one. I was, I don't know, chasing David Hasselhoff around in a car.
Right.
But it was super cool because, you know,
he
like
seems to get chased a lot in a lot of his things.
I guess.
Yeah.
But my first real acting job on a TV show, I was in a car chase.
That was great.
Super, which was looked on as sort of a stunt because the car was going fast.
Right.
And it was a convertible. And I'm like leaning out trying to catch the kit car and everything.
You did it yourself? So you did your own stunt work?
I did my own stunt work.
Did you get a bump?
Riding
did
in
you
a
get
car.
A stunt bump?
There was no stunt,
no
bump,
stunt
for,
bump
for riding in a convertible. But I did get a belt buckle. I got an International Stunt Association from my friend
cool.
Jack Gill, who's a historic, legendary stuntman with his whole family. So so that was super cool. Then, you know, then all kind of whatever. Family tie. Facts of life.
Yeah, facts of life.
Oh, they're, you know, Joe and the kids at the school want a scholarship money, but I was the captain of the football team named Moose, and I want to spend that money for a scoreboard for the football stadium. That kind of thing.
Goddamn Moose.
Yeah, so I started working in that kind of thing.
Yeah. As everyone knows, you were in a really small indie movie called Back to the Future.
Right.
It it did fairly well. I think people have heard of it.
Over
$800
at the box office.
Globally.
That's not a mega hit, but they do consider it a hit.
They do consider it a hit in some markets. Yes. In some markets. Well, I mean, I know you've been asked basically every question under the sun about it. So for me, I guess I really have like kind of mostly a question about sort of like the back end preparation, mm-hmm. especially because you went from sort of like the smaller stages of like theater, right? And then comedy, which is still at most like 400 people, right? Which is a lot, especially live. But then to shift to TV and then to shift to something that, you know, I guess going in, one, like, how did you navigate something that you knew potentially could be giving you work for, like, years and years to come?
I didn't know that. I didn't think about a thing that would give me work for years and years to come.
Okay.
I just thought, I'm going to work hard at this.
Yeah.
Because I didn't drive 3,000 miles to get out here and just do chewing gum commercials.
Right.
I came out here to really commit to something and to do great work.
Yeah.
So it was very nerve-wracking.
I can imagine.
When you're very young and you keep going up. I mean, I had to audition a lot of times, several times.
Yeah.
They want to see you again.
And,
they want to see you again.
Stuff.
They want to screen test you. They want to put old age makeup on you.
Wow.
And to see how you would act as an older man. Then you're in this conference room at Amblin Entertainment over at Universal, over on the Universal lot, and you're a very young guy, but there at this table is literally the heads of the studio and Steven Spielberg sitting right there, and Robert Zemeckis and all of these people. And I mean, it's impressive. But the fact is, you have to deliver.
Yeah.
You have to deliver.
Yeah.
So I went for it. I went for it as hard as I could. And at the end of that audition, I thought I blew it.
Really?
Yeah. I thought it was, you know, for that small room, I was a little over the top. Mm-hmm. It was a little too much. Mm-hmm. I sort of lost my way in the scene because I was improvising in the scene.
Mm-hmm.
I was acting with Crispin. So I really started to manhandle him. I mean, really kind of pulling him across the table. I mean, I lifted him into the air, you know, this kind of thing.
Yeah.
And I had the scene memorized, but sometimes when you do something like that, you really go out on a limb.
Yeah.
You know, that's the danger. You can lose your way in the scene to, okay, what do I do now? How does this scene turn in order to stop and say, I'm done? So you're sort of stuck. So I was stuck falling off of the high wire, you know, without a net and not knowing sort of where I was in the scene. And I just stopped. And I just looked at everybody. And there was that little uncomfortable 3 seconds. And they said, well, Tom, thanks so much. Thanks very much for coming in.
Yeah.
And thank you. And it was clear that they wanted Crispin to stay and me to go.
Right.
So I left and pretty much thought I blew it. I thought, I went for it. But yeah, that was it. I wrecked it. And then the next morning they called and said, you got it.
That's so crazy.
Yeah.
What was that moment like? Like, what is that feeling like when you get a call like that?
Back to being a young man with a lot of confidence in my work ethic and my talent.
Because now it finally has matched, right? Like,
right.
This whole time you've basically known that you could do it.
Right.
And then this is the first,
you know. I was, I think, 24 when I got cast.
Wow.
And that feeling was equal parts absolute euphoria and half, well, it's about time.
Right.
Because, I mean, I've been batting 600 in AAA baseball for a long time, people. I mean, I've been working hard at this. And you don't know that when you're 24. You just think, you know, like, I'm working, buddy.
Right.
So thank goodness somebody finally said, hey, man, this kid's good. So it was kind of that. But, of course, it was euphoria. It was, and intimidation because it's a movie.
Yeah. Because that's different than from TV, I imagine, and that kind of segues to my next question is, when you're preparing for like an acting role in TV, like with Zack Stone, right? Like we had a whole season. So you had a 13 episodes or 12, however many episodes worth of a backstory for your character. Mm-hmm. But oftentimes for a movie, it feels like they create even more detailed of a world, more detailed of a backstory. So is the preparation different for like a feature, which theoretically is shorter than a TV show season would be? Like
the difference at that time, and the difference I think still today, though it's changing, but the difference at that time was time.
Okay.
In a movie, a Steven Spielberg produced movie for Universal Studios, they want to make sure that this thing is as excellent as you can possibly make it.
Right.
So, if it's not right, the first 8 takes, we do 4 more. Mm-hmm. And if we don't like that, we could do 5 more of those until we're completely happy with what we're doing. Of course, there are time constraints, and you can't go forever and be Stanley Kubrick right. and just come back the next day and do the same take over and over. No, you can't do that. But on television, the demand was, we have to get this done.
Right.
Because the people with money give us the money to finish X amount of work in this day, and we got to finish it. So you would get 2 takes, 3 takes, maybe in a TV show. On a movie, they'll concentrate on it until it's right.
Interesting. So what is that like for your preparation? How does that change how you prepare?
We had, which is almost unheard of, we had a rehearsal process for the first Back to the Future.
Really?
Yeah. Where we got together in one of the rooms at Amblin, we rehearsed scenes, we talked about characters, all kinds of things.
Yeah.
From you know, showing us the various effects they were thinking about, taking us up to the sets, and you get to look at the pre-production things.
Yeah.
That was incredibly exciting. Telling us about just the various things, how the DeLorean, the visual work that will yeah. be done when the DeLorean goes into the future.
Like the practical, the fire.
The amount of work before computer graphics.
Yeah.
How much work went into, and then the front bumpers will start to glow blue. Then there will be lightning that comes under the car. Then all of these, then the car will, like the car will go through,
right.
like through time in order to crash, have fire going down the road. And, you know, and you can't visualize the whole thing.
Right.
But you do think, this is going to look really cool. So that, you know, that kind of thing. And you got to talk about the character, ways to think about the character.
Yeah. That doesn't normally happen for
that doesn't like, normally
features,
happen.
Right? Like,
well,
I know
it
some
depends.
People have
again,
I,
it's
yeah.
how the director is,
I guess
how much
kind of.
They want to talk about it,
yeah.
how much they want to dedicate themselves to pre-production of, you know, what we're trying to do with this.
Yeah.
But I mean, for Crispin and I, it was pretty much on the page.
Yeah.
You see, if it's, you know, the old adage, if it's on the page, it's on the stage. It's in, you can read it
yeah.
and understand what we're doing here.
Mm-hmm.
We can understand this scene
yeah.
pretty well. So we were doing that, and they were trying, Bob Zemeckis, the director, was trying to impress upon us the various themes sort of presented within the movie.
Mm-hmm.
And it's, you know, again, I'm a young guy, and they say, Marcia, could you set up Crispin and Tom going to Steven's screening room and watching The Man Who Shot Liberty Valance? So like after the rehearsal, we just go, you know, I'm a kid, and you go to Steven Spielberg's private screening room. You know, and you're calling your family afterwards. They have this snack bar, but there's no cashier. You just take, like, goobers, like, whatever you want. You know.
But there's no
like,
cashier.
No cashier.
There's
it's like
there.
It's like a stack of raisinets.
You just take whatever
you just,
want.
Like, take them, and you eat them and watch the movie. So we would watch a movie, a time movie like The Man Who Shot Liberty Valance,
right.
which is going back in time
right.
to look at the entire scene from a different perspective, those kinds of things. So we were doing that.
God, that's cool.
And then we started production.
That's awesome.
We started production, yeah.
And then obviously, like, I mean, there were the subsequent films, but did they do the similar pre-pro for the second and third film as
I think,
well?
Oh, yeah.
Rehearsal and everything?
Yeah, not so much rehearsal. Not so much, Yeah, there was certainly talk about the characters because it was different times, different characters. There's
right.
Griff. There's Buford Mad Dog mm-hmm. Tannen. There's different times. There's a subservient older Biff. There's a casino owner, evil older Biff. There's all
right.
these kinds of things and how to think about them and how to approach them within the story. So that was very, very, very challenging. And at that point, I was an experienced actor, but different time periods, different characterizations,
different
entire
even, yeah.
characters. So I got index cards and a bunch of highlighters of mm-hmm. all different colors that were color coded to specific characters, times and things. And I figured out my own sort of complicated way of thinking about it, these are scenes for Buford Mad Dog Tannen. These are scenes for the actual alternate Biff in the
right.
future. These are scenes of Biff in the past. Mm-hmm. The other views that you're looking at in the scene that was in the original Back to the Future.
Right.
So then I have to play that in nearly an exact way of how I did it in the first movie, because it's just like a different camera angle
right.
from the first movie. So I built my own
yeah.
system of trying to understand everything that was happening. I think it worked for me. I did okay at it.
Yeah, you were all right in the film. It was a mild success. I wouldn't get too excited about it. No, I'm just kidding.
Yeah.
At the scale of something like that, like not only with Spielberg, but then the studios, it's still something that, like, when you go to the Warner Brothers set, I mean, like, that shit accidentally burned down, and then they were like, "No, rebuild it. We got to rebuild it." Like,
yeah, I mean, it's in. I mean, it's.
Gilmore Girls was also shot there, though. So pretty exciting.
I don't talk about its immeasurable cultural significance.
Right.
Because it's impossible to put into words the size of it.
Of course.
And the funny thing is, everyone tries to impress upon me
as if you were not
its
part of
size
it.
And scope.
Right.
And I have to tell them, I came out of the airport in Hong Kong, China, and a guy pulling a rickshaw stopped to start speaking in Chinese about Back to the Future guy. So, I mean, I understand
right.
its scope and where it's gone.
Yeah.
But, yes, it's in it's in the National Register of motion pictures. When an act of Congress thinks that a movie is of such cultural significance that the American government should save the negatives
right.
in like one of those in gas filled drawers, and it's like that.
Yeah.
Like the presidents use it in State of the Union addresses. So I understand.
Yeah.
But again, you really can't wrap your head around it.
No.
Because I'm just an actor
sitting
in kind of a broken office chair in a sort of converted garage in Northridge, California. I'm a person.
Right.
I'm a person
right.
and an artist.
Right.
So it's very easy to get swept away with that
yeah.
and turn me into an object
top icon.
Of right yeah. and sort of just an object of looking at or
right.
Like I am put in the gas filled drawer along with the negative of the film
right.
Which is not the case. Does that make sense?
Absolutely. I mean, in the way that I could never grasp it because I haven't experienced it, but yes, it makes sense because it seems like it's an abstract idea of something that means so much to so many different people because film and art
right.
are subjective. And so
the amazing thing is, within as an actor, as an artist of any kind, with a movie like that, people want to impart their experience of the movie
right.
that was very personal and that was very, very memorable to them.
Right.
I understand that because I have movies like that. I watch those movies.
Yeah.
And something, I don't know what it is, but they want to tell me how much it meant to them.
Right.
They want to tell me that story.
Yeah.
And the unusual thing is no matter what you say, like that contact between them and me, mm-hmm. a human being, mm-hmm. you know, where we're touching hands right now.
Yeah.
It's kind of not good enough for them.
Right.
Because it's brought me down in just a person, you know? And they're trying to tell me that, you know, my parents got a divorce and my dad took us to this drive-in and I was so sad, you know?
Yeah.
And I saw that movie and I'm just a guy, you know? And I'm going, yes, I understand. You know, thank you for telling me that.
Right.
And something about it is like, you can see their longing to kind of, I need to communicate this more fully to him. But that's the thing.
Right.
Words can't describe your experience of
exactly.
seeing that.
Yeah.
And when you look at me, you know, there's something in you that's saying, well, I mean, it's just a guy. I mean, it's a person, right? It's just, he's not like a statue over at Universal Studios.
Right.
You know, he's not, he's the artist that was a part of it.
Yeah.
So we have a beautiful exchange and you try to be a person with them. Say, thank you for telling me that.
Mm-hmm.
I understand that it's meant a lot to you and to so many people.
Yeah.
And then you walk away and they, you know, you just kind of feel like they sort of in their face. I wish that would have gone better. Or I could walk away feeling like I imparted what I wanted to impart.
Right.
You know? So it's an unusual thing to be a part of. And I've talked about it with friends of mine, with a number of friends of mine. I mean, Mark Hamill is a friend of mine, and I know so many people. I mean, it's a relatively new experience for a human being.
Yeah.
In the history of humanity, to be seen by nearly everyone in the world.
Yeah.
And identified as a thing that you are not.
Yeah.
Because it's a movie. It's all pretend. At the end of beating up Michael J. Fox, they said cut, and we went together to get snacks.
Was the crafty good?
It was excellent.
Okay, good. That's all I need.
But
to
so
know.
It's a new experience for people.
Yeah, absolutely.
And some people, you know, God bless them, have taken it in very unhealthy ways. Very unhealthy ways.
Yeah.
And some, honestly, I mean, let's be real. Some have lost their lives over it. Over a lack of the ability to be identified as a person.
Yeah.
By people that see you at the mall or at places. So early on, I figured out I'm going to have to make a plan for this.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I'm going to have to live my life in a certain way where it's positive,
yeah.
where I'm okay with it. People are okay with
it. I was
gonna
say, I feel like your fans are really like pretty respectful of it, to, like, and really kind of like, especially your comedy fans and like touring fans.
A large number
yeah.
of them are.
Yeah.
A large number. But as yeah. we all know, and I'm not talking to the people who are listening to me right now and getting what I mean, but in a very impersonal, screen-based, narcissist society,
mm-hmm.
that percentage of the population, that piece of the pie
yeah.
that just wants the person to dance to their tune,
yeah.
do what I want.
Yeah.
Or I will flame you on the message board, or I will do X, Y, or Z.
Yeah.
I think that piece of the pie is larger than everyone thinks.
It's the Reddit piece. We like to call that the Reddit piece.
It's interesting. And I suppose, because some people have a hard time with separating movies from reality, because
right.
I was mean to that funny guy from Family Ties. A lot of people have something to say, have some Twitter flame for me, have some,
mm-hmm.
you know, have they have something to share with me that's not entirely healthy, you know, so.
Well, Twitter just lost Vine, so it's probably not going to be around for a lot longer.
That's the way. The good part is they're winnowing out as I don't answer them, as I just kind of cleanse it from the Twitter feed, as I block people, as I go onto Facebook in the morning to just take out that stuff or unfriend. It sort of winnows out.
Yeah.
They always show up, but you know, that's just a part of living in in such a connected, this wonderful, connected, miraculous world that we live in.
Hi, Facebook.
Does that make
Live.
Sense? Am I saying stuff? Sometimes I get off on one of these things and you're thinking, oh, shut up, man. You don't know what you're talking about.
No, it makes sense. But I also feel like it works for me because it shifts into another question I had, because you have been a part of a lot of things that just culturally have meant a lot to a lot of people, like Freaks and Geeks, mm-hmm. and especially working with Paul Feig again years later, doing The Heat, and having him bring you back. I just interviewed Trace Beaulieu a couple weeks ago, and so we talked about how Paul likes to bring people back and stuff, and so I feel like it's probably I could never probably understand the emotion that goes into it, but I imagine that with the other work that you continue to do, it must just feel good to know that there are these other benchmarks of things that you've done that are just as important to
cool
people as well.
You know what
I mean? Because Freaks and Geeks is something that, is such a touchstone for so many people for comedy, and your role is so... I was rewatching some stuff earlier and I was laughing at your cervix says no line was fucking funny. Those anatomy classes were so funny. It was just, the writing was so good. So I feel like for a lot of the projects you've done,
I've got to work with a lot of
amazing
directors.
Talent,
The good part of it is that people who make garbage on TV think of me in that pop cultural way.
Right.
Great directors have actually looked at the work and thought of me in a different way.
I love the scene of you in Freaks and Geeks where you're explaining to the
the John
main
Daly's
kid.
In there and I'm
about
explaining
how the anatomy.
Yeah.
The way that scene was done, I thought, and it's funny that you brought that up because I thought that they treated your character, and specifically you, because I've also to watch you work on Zack Stone, obviously. I loved the way that they affected that scene because they didn't actually really show any of the dialogue. They pulled it out to that wide shot and then the music comes and it's sort of it's all in your physical body language. They really let you guys.
Right. For those who haven't seen it, it's a scene, John Daly, a young man, he watches one of those, a stag film.
Yeah, like
a
old school
porno. An
old
school porno thing. But that's an odd one.
And he has
that
questions.
Is up, so he doesn't understand it because it was kind of a weird one and it sort of upsets him. I played the gym teacher, who is of course a gym teacher, but a decent guy.
Decent. It wasn't that archetype.
Right. Who hears this story of what happened and who takes the boy into his office to say, look, I could get in a lot of trouble for talking about this with you.
You were some men, not me, some men.
Right. But this is what happens and I'm going to explain to you.
Yeah.
The deal, okay, but this is between us. And he says, okay. And then it's a montage with music and me kind of explaining the facts of life.
I just thought it was such a well-directed scene.
Right, and it's a touching scene between a man and a man and a young man in scene. The man is imparting real life knowledge.
Yeah.
And at the end, they shake hands as friends.
Well, it was the first time your character in the series up until that point had really been seen as that archetype. Or anything other than that archetype of the gym teacher, which, and I don't know, that one in particular was very touching for me.
So I've gotten to work with great, Stuart Rosenberg and Taylor Hackford and John Frankenheimer and just all kinds of brilliant directors watching their process, talking to them about their careers.
Yeah.
And it's been, it's been an adventure beyond anything I could have ever imagined.
And you're doing a bunch of stuff now. You're on School of Rock. And
I just did a show called Training Day. I did a Workaholics episode. I do a lot of voiceover stuff. over at Nickelodeon.
Say, and a new, you just did The Ranch, right?
Too, yeah, on Netflix. I do some SpongeBob SquarePants. I do a show called Pig Goat Banana Cricket over there.
Oh,
so
yeah.
I play a psychotic banana.
But you were also
on television. It's all come full circle.
You did. You
I like always dreamt of being a psychotic banana.
Angry Beavers, All Real Monsters.
All kinds
so you've
of
had
stuff.
A good working relationship with Nickelodeon for a while.
I have.
Too.
I have. It's great there.
That's awesome.
They're very supportive. They're great people. It's a really creative process there.
Yeah.
And I love it.
So I will have a very irate mother-in-law if I do not ask you one question.
Yes.
So for a lot of maybe the people who I know some of you know, maybe some you don't, you're like a really amazing painter. You paint, you do showings sometimes at like Disneyland and
I've
stuff like that.
I've been shown at a lot of galleries and have showings. I studied at the Art Academy of Los Angeles, California Art Institute, studied drawing and painting. And
How long have you been doing that?
Oh, a very long time now. In a few decades. Yeah. I just, if you're going to work as an actor, there are many periods where, honestly, you don't feel that creative.
Yeah.
Because you're playing irate dad on some sitcom, which, you know, it's not that inspiring a scene. And come on, you're doing it to pay for your health plan and to pay for groceries.
Right.
You know, it's not something. So that's one of those early on things. I do the stage, I do stand up in order to be creative, and I paint.
Yeah.
And I do visual arts in order to be creative because I don't need anyone's permission to make a painting.
Yeah.
I don't have to audition myself. I don't have to. It's absolutely I can buy the stuff at a store, make a painting, and I could put it up on a wall somewhere.
Mm-hmm.
So that has been great for me. And yes, I've shown Nickelodeon. I was the first actor on Nickelodeon shows who actually had a solo exhibition at Nickelodeon World Headquarters, the gallery. There's a gallery that they have there where they feature the art of the artists who work at Nickelodeon, if they're painters or whatever. And they have this space and they put it up. And you apply. It's a whole application process of showing your body of work as a painter and everything. So Steven Hillenburg, who created SpongeBob, who was an old friend of mine, and he said, you know, I mean, your painting, I really like your paintings. You should go and apply for this Nickelodeon Gallery. So I did. They accepted it. I had 40 paintings up in the Nickelodeon Gallery. That was great.
Yeah.
Then Disney had a thing called the Disney Featured Artist for California Adventure, for Disneyland, where you applied at Disney.
Yeah.
And you said, this is how I would see it through my... through my eyes, how I would present Disney. I was lucky in that one. I got accepted as a Disney featured artist. I had a solo exhibition at the Disney Gallery, at Disneyland, on Main Street, at the California Adventure. But my paintings were good, and Disney liked them. But I think I was a little lucky in that one, because every artist in the country was applying to do that.
Yeah.
Because... But they were, a lot of them were doing things that all looked alike, you know, kind of a comic book looking thing. Oh, I'll make Goofy and Mickey in a car, and they're at a stoplight, and some giant rabbit just came, you know, that kind of thing.
Right.
So it was a lot of illustration looking art, and I, with my take on myself being a pop object, I paint a lot of kind of heroically lit objects.
Mm-hmm.
So my thing was just Disney ride vehicles and Disney props that have been used, but without any people, not an illustration, not a kid on the ride, just the ride itself. So the painting will be about not that kid on the ride. The painting is about your experience on the ride, your memories of being at Disneyland.
Yeah.
So I did a big Disney fire truck, all kinds of things.
Yeah.
So that was great. And I worked with Disney a bunch, so they showed my paintings, and
we go. We like had Disney annual passes because I'm a very hardcore person who likes to party.
I got to go to Disneyland.
Have you been to Club 33?
Yes, I have.
Shut.
I've been to Club 33.
Oh, that's all I
had the
do.
World Historic Fruit Punch at Club 33.
God.
I was at Disneyland. They let me. I said I need to see the things without people on them. I need to see the things alone, like lit. I need to sort of photograph around to see, to go home and look at them and see what kind of objects. So they said, well, on this day, show up at Disneyland at 3:30 in the morning. So I drive up, you know, it's the middle of the night. And I think, you know, it's going to be crickets and everything. Well, Tom, I'll let you in, but hold the flashlight close to your body because, you know. So I go to Disneyland at 3:30 in the morning. It is floodlights. A city.
Yeah.
Floodlights everywhere. Giant trucks. They're steam cleaning. Oh. Guys with brooms everywhere. They're brushing. They're cleaning every Dumbo. I mean, it is.
That's all I want to do in my life is like do what you just.
It
like.
Is a buzzing beehive. So they led me walking like through the Peter Pan ride. Through to look at Wendy, like walking the plank, to look at the ride vehicles, to go in to where the train, the Disneyland train, actually parks at night, to actually look at the pieces.
Oh,
I went to
man.
Where the monorails park and where the track is and all that, just to be able to see all of the objects of Disneyland, to see what I would paint. So
I don't know why this is like, I'm like,
it was really super cool.
This is all I want to do in life.
It was super cool. It was really, wow. really cool. Yeah.
That's so yeah. cool.
And then during the day, you just find out those little trap door things that takes you to offices.
Yeah.
I mean, you're in the middle of Cars Land.
Yeah.
And they say, right this way. And you go through. Skip. I'm in cubicle land with office workers and everything. I was just in Disneyland like 3 seconds ago. And now I'm in an office building. What is this?
We went on a, after we got married, we went to Disneyland or Disney World because we got married in Florida for like a couple of days. And they have this thing where you can dine with an Imagineer.
Oh, sure.
And so I had been trying to call for, I swear to God, like 2 months and being like, let me get a reservation. Everything was booked. I like begged them on the day and they totally squeezed us in. So it was us and 10 other people and an Imagineer. And
nice.
That was it. And so we got to totally
yeah.
nerd out and everything. So I probably would have. Just figured out a way to stay in Disneyland when I visited, like you did. I would have just like burrowed away
yeah,
in the
yeah.
Peter Pan ride and just been like, no, I live here now. Like, I just,
right.
Because Club 33 and then staying in the Dream Suite, that's all I want
to
do.
The Dream Suite used to be the Disney Gallery.
Really?
Yes. The Is Disney
that where...
That's where I showed. The
oh,
Disney
cool.
Gallery was the Dream Suite there. Where I showed all my paintings.
And they moved it to Main Street.
So,
now,
yeah.
Though.
So Disneyland yeah. was showing. Artists having solo exhibitions, having the Disney artists showing their work. And an oil painting of that kind will cost, you know, $2,000 or $3,000.
Yeah.
It's very difficult to make. It takes a long time. So oil paintings are expensive. So oil paintings don't sell like gangbusters. They're not
yeah.
just flying off the wall toward people. So Disney's idea was, you know, I don't think we're making enough on this gallery. We're not moving paintings
right
out and
front.
Making. So they made the Dream Suite and immediately booked, you know, for thousands of dollars, but booked every night.
Yeah.
Waiting list.
I just want to be rich enough to have Snoop Dogg invite me onto his, like, he has his own show. That's it. I just want to do that. And then I just want to be able to go to Club 33 and the Dream Suite. And everybody
I
keeps
think
telling
those
me
are
that
very,
those...
very simple dreams.
See, everybody keeps telling me that they're impossible.
And
as
let
if...
me try to inspire you to higher dreams.
Thank you. So
maybe some self-acceptance and satisfaction of living a life of peace and tranquility with your
Club
husband.
Club 33 list life? I don't know about that.
All right. All right. Do you
so
think?
I know we've been going for a little too long, so
yeah.
I'll wrap up with like one last question.
Okay.
And it's more... for the listeners who are also like artists as well, because
mm-hmm.
I thankfully have built an audience of a lot of people who are working artists too. And I guess the one question I love to ask is if you had any advice to people who are on their one packet of ramen or are, you know, there from 5:30 to 2 to try to get some stage time, like what advice can you give them to just keep going?
I think being an artist calls for not constant, not every day, but regular self-examination.
Mm-hmm.
Because there's a little dropper of poison that is involved with being an artist.
Right.
And that poison is comparison. That poison is the wish to be a big shot. You have to examine whether being a big shot is the important thing to you, or having a voice and making your art, whatever that is important to you. If you want to be a big shot, that road is nearly impossible, and it's a road of very, very deep frustration. And as we see looking at things, it's a road of self-recrimination and doubt, ultimately often alcoholism, drug use, and possibly death, until someone gets it into their head. Do you have a voice? Do you have something to say? Because I'll tell you, honest to goodness, you can do that today. Mm-hmm. You can open your notebook like I did, mm-hmm. and you can start writing things down. Or you can start drawing something. Or you can go to an open mic and you can just say things that are on your mind. Mm-hmm. You can do that today. Hopefully, yes. It leads to success, and it leads to all kinds of things. Interesting relationships, directions in your life that you never could have imagined, but that just happened through some artistic happenstance of coming to some intersection and taking one direction and not the other direction. And that is a spectacular adventure. But I think you have to keep reminding yourself of that, that you are on a spectacular adventure. You're not just trying to be like him or like her who's your age and is on a TV show, or who is your age and is on Saturday Night Live, or who is your age and wrote a book that everyone's reading, or who is your... You need to... Okay, we're all human beings. You can't completely cleanse that from your consciousness, of course. But you have to keep thinking, what is it that I, me, mm-hmm. what is it that I have to share with the world? What ways do I communicate?
Yeah.
What ways do I enjoy? What feeds me? Where at the end of making a painting, or at the end of sometimes creating a character in a movie or a TV show, I really don't care if everybody hates it, because right. I love it.
Right.
That's the thing. If you keep in mind that you're doing things that you love, it doesn't matter if everybody else hates it. The hatred thing, everyone hating it, that's comparing to the guy who everyone loves.
Right.
And there's so much sort of fashion and so much, you know, fake internet adulation about that stuff. Do your thing, because you can do your thing right now.
Yeah.
Does that make sense?
It makes complete sense. Like it actually is a good segue. You probably don't remember this, but like 4 years ago when we were on Zack Stone, I had been working for the show for like 9 months, like an entire pregnancy at that point. We were filming and we were in the block, and you and I were just sitting over at Village one day. And you started talking to me and you were like, you know, what are your plans? And like, you as one of the stars of the show saw me, the PA, as the person. It was sort of what you were talking about. You saw me as a human being, and we were talking. And I sort of was saying, you know, I really want to write, and I want to direct, and I want to produce, and all of that. And you looked at me and you said, you know, Virginia, I've been in this business for a really long time, and trust me when I say this, you're going to go far. And I floated on that emotional currency of somebody that I respected in a position that way, seeing me in that moment and telling me like, hey, I see what you're doing. I see that you're working. I see that you're trying, and this will eventually pay off for you. And it was, I was never sure if I'd be able to actually have this moment where I told you how much it meant to me. But in that moment, I hope people listening actually really take this to heart, because you are just as genuine like this in person when we are on set. 4 years ago, when I was 22 years old, holding all my bags of scripts, and that to me was everything. And like, I just directed my first piece this year. Like, I just like wrote it and directed it and edited it. And it's funny because I think sometimes the only thing people need to hear to keep going is like, I see you, keep going. Like, I see what you're doing, keep going. And that, like, that for me was such an important like touchstone. Like, I talked about it on the show on the last episode. It was like such an important moment for me, because there were times later where I was working at like a soap store because I like, you know, there was no work. And so I had to, you know, but in the back of my mind, I always had that like, well, Tom Wilson said that he, you know, that I'm going to, and it was that, you know, that idea that there are those people that will see what you're doing and will, you know, there are those casting directors that will see you and say, you're a great actor. This is might not be the role for you, but like, we will see something else for you in the future. And I think that that like, for so many artists is like enough to just keep going, you know, and to keep that flame
going.
You have to
take all those things into your heart. I think it happens with all artists.
Yeah.
So I try to do it with people, not with everybody.
Yeah.
I think, look, I'm, you know, I'm this wonderful guy that talks from my heart. I do. But I'm in show business. I see a lot of people who I think are lazy and who are just kind of doing a repetition of another person, doing a repetition of another person. That's just kind of, you know, like, hey, there's stand-up comedians who just figure out a way to do 8 minutes because you get a free beer.
Right.
And you could talk to girls because you were just on stage. You know, I'm not, hey, buddy, thumbs up. Way to go. No, I think it's lazy, and I hope he quit show business. I hope he, you know, make room. I really, you know, I'm hard in that way.
Yeah.
I think the winnowing process is okay.
Yeah.
If you can't do it,
yeah.
If it's too much for you because it's a lot,
yeah.
Then yes, go home to wherever you're from,
yeah.
And do something that will make you happy. I'm glad it will make you happy,
yeah.
But this isn't it.
Right.
You know, but I think you're great. I think you'll do well. But like I said, I don't steal from how good this moment is with us.
Right.
Because you're taking away from this moment because you're thinking, yeah, but when it's great, when 100,000 people are listening to it, then it will be, you know, then it will be X.
Right.
No, it's fine right now.
That's kind of why I started it. Like, right. It's mostly just because I started last year because I just like wanted to. So for me, it goes back to what you're saying. It's like the doing of the thing for me is
the doing of
enough.
The thing.
Like, it's,
when I was in plays in high school, I tell young people in high school, see, when I was in the play in high school, that feeling is exactly the same feeling as being in a gigantic movie that the entire world loves and wants to tell you how great it was. The feeling, the inside feeling, is exactly the same.
Mm-hmm.
So just don't forget, like, enjoy that feeling.
Oh, dude, no, I feel that.
And
like,
enjoy that feeling of that was exciting.
Yeah.
We were on stage and the audience loved it and it was great.
I think the note about comparison is probably like the most relatable. I feel like everybody was like shaking their heads when I was like listening to you talk, because I feel like especially with our generation and the internet, it does feel hard sometimes to not compare yourself to the person who's like a YouTube star or whatever it is, you know what I mean? But I think that's like such relatable advice. I don't know. I was like watching you just like shake your head. Like, you were like approving dad over there. You were, like,
I just see it a lot. I see it, you know, I see it a lot. It's the, you know, you're a vlogger. Oh, but not Casey Neistat. Oh, you're an actor. Yeah, Matt Damon, he's really, whatever
right.
it is, what anything.
Right.
There's some, just do what you do.
Yeah.
It's fine. It's great.
I like
Enjoy
that.
Enjoy it.
I like that. Can I think that's probably good. I'm never good at like wrapping things up. This happens every time to where I'm like, maybe I should get like a catchphrase or like a sign off, and then it's never happened.
Zing.
Yeah, no.
And then you just cut it off. And then you don't have any music at the end.
No, it's
or
just,
it's just
it's
like
literally pop, just
into
done.
Static.
Yeah.
It like you get sound effects of static. So you just record this with me just going zing, and then it just and that's the end of the show.
I'm not even gonna buy static. I'm just gonna use
exactly.
your fake just, static.
Okay, here,
fully.
We'll use it. Okay, quiet. Zing. Okay, that was it.